Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. My guest today is Robin Hutton, author of War Animals, The Unsung Heroes of World War II. Robin Hutton has spent her adult life working in major event productions in the motion picture business. She's the author of the national best-selling book Sergeant Reckless, America's War Horse, and she's president of Angels Without Wings, a nonprofit corporation that spearheaded the development and dedication of three national monuments to Sergeant Reckless. Ms. Hutton was named Patriotic Citizen of the Year by the Military Order of the Purple Heart for her charitable work. So, Robin, welcome to the podcast.
Well, Joe, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, by taking on a book like this, is it safe to assume that you're an animal lover?
I am an animal lover. It's crazy how much I love animals, you know, from horses to dogs to birds. You know, they're just such noble creatures. So this book has been a wonderful labor of love.
Wonderful. Now, to get into the book, you know, you start with World War II, mm-hmm. and when the war began, the U.S. had no war dog program. Mm-hmm. So how did a poodle breeder and a newspaper columnist get one started?
Wasn't that something? Well, after Pearl Harbor struck, Arlene Erlanger, who was a poodle breeder, and she was very much into the dogs with the American Kennel Club, and they decided that the dogs needed to get into this to help protect our ammunitions plants, our airports, all these kind of munitions areas. And so she got together with her friends and started Dogs for Defense. And essentially, they put out a national cry for people to donate their own dogs to the war cause, because we had nothing. Mm-hmm. And the Army would then train them. And because Arlene was a trainer and a breeder, she also would provide training for these dogs. So the Army was really the one that started all of this with the war dog program. And then the Marine Corps came along, and the Army provided some of their dogs for the Marines. And then the Doberman Pinscher Club started, mm-hmm. and they donated all their dogs to the Marine Corps. And so it was an amazing sense of patriotism to try to really dive into this problem, and hopefully that the animals would really do something special. And right. They did.
Yeah. Now, and you mentioned, you know, the Dobermans, and she obviously loved poodles. Which breeds worked best for the Canine Corps?
You know, the best ones actually were the German Shepherds, the Belgian Malinois. Doberman Pinschers were used at first, but they were found to be a little bit too high-strung. Huskies were also used. But it's really funny, the poodles actually made the first cut, mm-hmm. and because they're very, very smart dogs. But their hair, their coat was a little bit more difficult to take care of. So
high maintenance. They,
yeah, I know. So they actually didn't make the final cut. But especially the German Shepherds today still are amazing in what they do for our armed forces.
And they were the official dog of the Army, right?
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm.
All right, so people were donating their pets, but I imagine a lot of people wanted to keep their pets at home. There was a method for them to still contribute to the war effort,
yes.
The War Dog Fund.
Right, mm-hmm. And that's such a cute, I mean, they were so smart with all of this, Joe, you know. 40,000 dogs were donated at first for the war dog, for Dogs for Defense. Now, not all the dogs made the cut, only about 20,000 did, and ultimately 10,425 went to war. So those that couldn't participate with their dogs, the War Dog Fund was a fundraising that was started. And so for a dollar, you can have your dog be part of the league, essentially. Mm-hmm. And you were a private at a dollar. It would go up to $5 for a sergeant or something like that. $100 bought you the general or an admiral position. And President Roosevelt's dog, Falla, they donated a dollar, and Falla became a private in the War Dog Fund. And there's a really cute picture in the book.
A little doggy grunt.
Huh? I know, it's just great. It's just really clever.
So obviously, you had the dogs at home were able to contribute this way. The dogs that did go to the Canine Corps, and the recruits went off to basic training, right?
Right, yes.
So what was that like? And then what kind of specialized training did they get after that?
You know, it was really interesting because with the training, so many of these dogs just had no idea. They had to be taught, especially ones that were going overseas into the theater of Europe and also in the Pacific. They had to get used to the gun noises. They had to get used to smoke, to bombs. And there's no way really to prepare an animal for that. But they would go out and they would put them through the paces, essentially. And try to get them used to the noise and stuff. So they also would train them to become sentry dogs. Mm-hmm. And those were the ones that would stand guard the munitions plants. And they were basically attack dogs as well. And then overseas, they would train them to be messenger dogs. or silent scout dogs that would go through the jungles or through when they were walking through an area that the enemy might be in. These dogs had to alert, but they couldn't bark. They couldn't do anything that would maybe draw attention to where they were.
Right.
And so, you know, you'd have to, as a handler, you had to be able to read your dog. Now, the interesting thing when this whole Dogs for Defense started, they didn't have dog handlers to handle all of these dogs. So those dog handlers had to go into training as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really, really interesting to see how all of this really took place in World War II for us. And in Great Britain, they had a war dog program. They had one in World War I, and then they opened it again in World War II. And Great Britain sent their people over to help train the army with what they found to be the best tactics for the dogs.
Now, again, tying with the training, I think you had mentioned in the book that kind of a celebrity trainer involved in the early days.
Yes, there was, you know, and he had his dog Toto, you know, from The Wizard of Oz, his dog Toto. And it was amazing what he did. He actually also, when the dogs went to Camp Pendleton, he came over to Camp Pendleton. He was actually in LA, so he just went down to Camp Pendleton and down in Oceanside, California, and trained the dogs down there to be a more specialized training.
Right.
And so it was really kind of fun that Spitz, I think, was it.
Carl Spitz, yeah.
Carl Spitz. Mm-hmm. And so it was really kind of fun that he did that.
You talk about, you know, sentry duty back here in the homeland, and then overseas you had the Silent Scouts you mentioned,
right,
and messenger dogs. So, I mean, you're seeing dogs in combat for the
Absolutely.
First time.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the first canine hero of the war that you mentioned was Chips.
Yes.
He's also the most highly decorated.
He sure was. Chips is actually the highest decorated dog in American history. And I say that because he actually received the Silver Star.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, the Silver Star was taken away from him because he was a dog. But nevertheless, he's the only animal to actually receive the Silver Star. And he was amazing. He was with the Army, and he was participated in Operation Torch, the very first landing that the Americans participated in November of 42. In Africa. And then he guarded President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill in the 10-day Casablanca conference that where all the Allied forces got together and decided unconditional surrender was the only method that they would agree to for Japan and the Germans. But he really, his day of destiny was in the invasion of Sicily, which was one of the largest combined operations of the war at that time. And he was part of the landing on Licata, which was on the western, the far left side of the landing. There were three landings that Patton was doing. And so the guys hit the beach, and there was an Italian gun nest up by the jungle or the woods up there that was firing upon them as they hit the beach. And so his handler hit the ground. Well, Chips broke free, charged the machine gun nest. The men heard shots going off in the machine gun nest, thinking, oh my gosh, what's happening?
Sure.
Suddenly, Chips drags the gunner out of the nest, and then behind him are three other Italians with their hands raised because they were more afraid of this war dog
right.
than they were of being a POW.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, because of his actions, he not only saved his platoon, but they were able to advance the farthest that day on the invasion of Sicily. And we actually nominated Chips for a very prestigious award that's given in Great Britain called the Dickon Medal.
Okay.
And this medal was given to, it started in World War II, and it was given to 18 dogs, 32 pigeons, 3 horses, and a cat. So I nominated Chips in 2018, and he received it. And what was so wonderful was when Chips was sent to war, little Johnny Wren gave his war dog up to the Army when he was 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And Chips returned home after the war. And it was a huge photographs and publicity when he returned home because he was one of the first dogs to return home.
Right.
And little Johnny Wren met his war dog at the train station and stuff. Well, it was so wonderful for me to see big Johnny Wren go and at the Churchill War Room in London receive the Dickon Medal for his war dog Chips.
That's fantastic.
And it was just great to finally see him. His Silver Star was taken away, but still he got the Victoria Cross for animals.
Right.
So
yeah, I think he had been nominated also for a Purple Heart, right?
Yes, he did. Yes, he sure was. And that also was revoked. And actually, he was cited for the Distinguished Service Cross, but he received the Silver Star. And
because of regulations against giving medals to animals.
Absolutely. So, but he, nonetheless, what he did was amazing, you know, and you think that these dogs had no voice and had no choice and just served as valiantly as their two-legged compatriots. And so it's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I love the, you have one little vignette in the book, you know, speaking of Johnny Wren. Once Chips comes back and he's kind of hanging around the neighborhood, there's a little problem with one of the neighbor kids, right?
I loved that story when John told me the story. I was laughing so hard, Joe. It was really cute. He was telling me how when he was so proud to have his war dog home, he had this little army outfit that his mom had given him, and he'd had his rifle, and he's marching down the street and with his war dog by his side, and he's saluting the neighbors. Well, one of the kids comes running at them with a cap gun and starts firing at John and Chips. And I said, oh, my gosh, John, what happened? What did Chips do? You know, and I said, did he bite him? Did he attack him? And he said, no, it was more like a growl and a snap. And he just ripped the gun out of the kid's hand. And the kid went running into the house crying. And now suddenly Chips is this dangerous war dog, you know, in the neighborhood. But it wasn't that.
Not every dog that was in the war was facing combat, so there were a lot of dogs and other pets that helped raise morale by serving as mascots.
Yes, and that's absolutely right.
And there was one little Yorkie Terrier that was very photogenic. Tell us about Smokey and how he became famous.
Now, Smokey, it's really amazing. If you think about it, Smokey was actually found in a foxhole in New Guinea. How she landed in a foxhole in New Guinea, I don't understand. She somehow got lost from her owner. And Bill Wynn befriended Smokey and took her under his wing, so to speak. He was with the squadron, and he was a photographer with the squadron. And so Smokey would fly with him and was always become a part of what he was doing because he just loved this dog so much. And she was such a morale booster for everybody.
Right.
But what Smokey did, it was really amazing because in Luzon, in the Philippines, they needed to string communication wire across a 70-foot landing strip, and they were going to have to dig up the landing strip. Instead, because Smokey was so tiny, they were able to strap a string and have her walk through an 8-inch pipe across this land, underneath this landing strip, and they were able to string the communication wire through this landing strip. So they didn't have to tear it up. They didn't have to move the planes. They didn't have to show themselves to be visible, and saved really the lives of a lot of people that were there on the island there because it would have opened themselves up to attack from the Japanese. So she was just this great little dog, and she became the mascot of the Southwest, and she would go into the hospitals and would visit the beds of the sick army and, you know, sailors, whoever were in the hospital. She would visit with them and made them feel better. Bill taught her to do all kinds of tricks, like she'd get up on a drum and walk the drum, or she'd play dead, and she would just walk a tightrope. I mean, she was just this wonderful character.
And a paratrooper too, right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Oh my gosh, there's a picture of her in the book where she's coming down in a parachute. She was just an adorable little dog. And then there was Sinbad with the Coast Guard, who the motto was that as long as Sinbad was on the ship would never, you know, would be safe. And even today, Sinbad lives in a Coast Guard cutter named the Climber. And there's a statue of him inside this the ship. And it said Sinbad lives. And as long as Sinbad's on that ship, no harm will come.
Your legacy goes on.
I know. Yeah. Isn't that great? Yeah. You just love it.
All right. Now, you know, moving from dogs to birds, can you tell us a little bit about how the pigeons were used in warfare?
Well, you know, pigeons were the latest technology, I guess you would have. The only technology they had, other than, of course, the radios. But what happened, especially in the Pacific, the jungles were so dense that a lot of the communication couldn't get through, or the Japanese would cut the communication wires. And so there wouldn't be any kind form of communication between the different units. And so they would have to use these homing pigeons. And like the dogs, for defense, pigeon breeders donated their best racing pigeons to the cause. It was amazing how many homing birds that were racers were donated to the cause back in the day. And these animals were amazing. These warbirds, the number of lives they saved by being able to get their messages through was stunning. And you don't know how they home, and what was especially tough with these birds is they would be in mobile lofts. You know, they couldn't fly back to their lofts in America, of course, but they would be in lofts in England or in Africa. A lot of them were hatched in Africa that we used. But they would have to have mobile lofts. So for these birds to actually figure out where their mobile loft was, you know, maybe not had been at a place very long, it's fascinating for me to see that. And especially the ones that had to fly from France over the English Channel into England.
Yeah, the distances are quite amazing.
Crazy. And the kind of weather that they had to do. And, you know, just getting off the land, you know, they had were shot at. They had snipers shooting at them. The Germans had falcons that they would release to try to attack these pigeons and take them down, and because they didn't want the messages to get through.
Sure.
And it was really, it's just a fascinating piece of history.
Yeah, you mentioned like 95% of messages were able to get through.
They were able to get through,
so phone lines could be cut, couriers could be intercepted, but the birds got through.
Absolutely. And it was really something, Joe, because you know, we had quite a few birds that we used, and the British, of course, used a lot of birds, too. And it was wonderful to see how they would all work together in trying to help each other through these situations. But these birds were amazing, absolutely amazing.
And the ones that the U.S. were using, probably the two most famous were Cherami from First World War and G.I. Joe from the Second.
So right.
Tell us about them.
Cherami was this amazing bird that actually saved her platoon. It's called the Lost Battalion. And actually, there's a Disney movie, Ricky Schroeder plays the Lost Battalion.
Going back a little while,
with,
I guess.
With Cherami in there. But she was with this battalion that had gone into no man's land in France. And sadly, they had kind of veered off the course, and the headquarters really didn't know where they were. So the area that they thought where the enemy was, they started shelling. Well, it was friendly fire, and it was killing the Americans in this platoon.
Right.
And so they finally were able to get a message on to Cherami. She was the last hope. Their communication lines had been cut. Last hope. One of the other birds had gone down that they had. And so they attached this onto her. They basically said, stop it, it's friendly fire, you're shooting us, you know. And there's a copy of the message in the book, which is really kind of cool. But she actually was shot through the breastbone by the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And she injured her eye, so she lost her eye. And by the time she got through, her leg had also been severed. And it was hanging, the capsule was hanging on by a tendon. And because she got her message through, the shelling had stopped and the rest of the men of the Lost Battalion were saved.
And it was something like 20, 25 miles, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah, it was amazing. And actually, she is stuffed and in an exhibit at the Smithsonian Institute, along with Stubby, Sergeant Stubby, the dog from World War One.
So people could go visit.
Yeah, you go visit. You go see Cherami. Yeah, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
And soon people will be able to go visit G.I. Joe, is that right?
Yes, G.I. Joe. Actually, G.I. Joe is America's most famous pigeon, I believe. G.I. Joe flew 20 miles in 20 minutes and stopped the planes on the tarmac from taking off and bombing a town named Colcovecchia in Italy. The Brits had just taken it over. The Germans surrendered the town 20 minutes before the bombing mission was going to take place and bomb the town. And because of G.I. Joe's fast pace, 20 miles in 20 minutes is amazing.
Right.
He saved over 100 lives of the British. And so they awarded G.I. Joe back in the day with the Dickin Medal.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the only animal during World War II to receive, American animal, to receive that medal. And they flew him back over to England after the war to receive his medal. And it was given to him. There was probably 600 people in attendance at the Tower of London for G.I. Joe. All the Army guys showed up. The Air Force guys showed up to present G.I. Joe with this very prestigious medal. So it's a very cool story.
Wow.
So, and he's going to be at the museum, Army Museum, when it opens up.
Yep.
He'll be on display. He's stuffed and on display. So
we can all look forward to that next year when
next
that opens
year.
Up down at Fort Belvoir.
Yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned G.I. Joe getting the Dickin and going to another Dickin recipient, one with hooves,
your
favorite, Sergeant Reckless. So, she was a Marine Corps horse.
Yes. Sergeant Reckless was during the Korean War, and she's America's greatest war horse. There'll never be another horse like Reckless. She was a Korean-bred horse, bred to be a racehorse.
Mm-hmm.
She was just a little pony. But the Marines purchased her, a lieutenant purchased her for the recoilless rifle platoon to carry these canisters of ammunition, each weighed 24 pounds. So a man could only carry two or three at a time
mm-hmm.
and make only, four or five trips up the hill. But they thought, you know, a pack animal could really do something, you know, very good. So they found Reckless at their Seoul racetrack. The only reason the young Korean man sold his beloved horse to the Marine Corps was to buy an artificial leg for his sister.
Oh,
she lost hers in a landmine accident. But his loss was the Marine Corps gain. And they trained her to go up and down the hills by herself.
Mm-hmm.
They trained her to get in and out of the trailer. They trained her to run for her bunker when incoming came in. And she only needed to be shown something once or twice. And it was amazing how she was able then to perform. In this one particular battle, the Battle of Outpost Vegas in March of 53, she made 51 trips up to the guns most of the time by herself. She carried 386 rounds, which is over 9,000 pounds on her back. She was wounded twice, never stopped. You know, this was 35 miles she walked up and down these hills and, you know, view of the enemy. There was so much incoming and outgoing fire that they were colliding midair and like fireworks just raining down on the troops. And that's how she was hit with shrapnel in her forehead and her left flank. And but it didn't slow her down. And because of her efforts that day, she carried wounded off the battlefield. We don't know how many, but in my book, Sergeant Reckless, I talk about three verified instances of her carrying wounded off.
Right.
But just a few months later, the armistice took place because she was able really to keep the guns so well supplied that the Marines were able to perform a lot better than the enemy thought. So it's just amazing what she did. And
right.
She was the first one to get the Dickin Medal of all of these animals. When I discovered her story and I was researching the medal, that's when I discovered so many of the animals that received the Dickin Medal that are in my book.
Yeah, you mentioned, you mentioned the horse and mules.
Yes.
And you've got the pigeons and the dogs, and you wrap up the book with the
Simon
one
the
dog,
cat.
Yeah, the one cat recipient.
There is a war cat, believe it or not, people. And Simon is just this beautiful black and white cat, and he was found in Singapore. And he was aboard a ship on the Amethyst with the that went up the Yangtze River,
mm-hmm.
and with the Royal Navy. And the ship was shelled. It was during the time of Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek fighting each other. And the British, they flew, you know, white flag. They were not part of this, but it didn't matter. The ship was attacked. 21 sailors were killed, and the skipper was killed. And Simon was very, very injured, very mm-hmm. badly. And he was a great mascot on the ship. You know, the men loved him. The captain, former captain, used to have him sleep in his cap up in his bunk, you know.
Right.
I mean, he was just beloved. So when he got injured, he didn't come out for a couple of days. And so he had four pieces of shrapnel that they had to remove. And while he was in sick bay, he became the very first therapy cat, because he would jump up on the beds of the men and start kneading his paws and purring and everything. And as he felt better, they felt better. Finally, after about a week or so in sick bay, the ship was stranded on the Yangtze River for 101 days.
Mm-hmm.
And the rats were starting to come onto the ship and threaten not only the disease because of the rats, but also the food supplies. So Simon was in charge of killing the rats, and he killed at least one rat a day, which boosted morale.
Sure.
And he kept the food supplies, you know, clean, and kept the, you know, men healthy. And so he received the Dickin Medal. By the time the ship ran for it and ended up in Hong Kong, he was a hero. And when as just ships pulling in, they mentioned Simon coming off the boat, you know, and it's very cute. Some of these old reels that British Path had done talking about Simon and all of these wonderful birds and everything. It's really cute.
Definitely a sweet way to wrap up the book.
And it is. Yeah.
Now, you know, most of the animals that we've been talking about have local memorials.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if there's plans for some kind of national recognition.
Yes, I'm glad you asked about that. We have several things that we want to do. Working with these animals so closely, of course, my heart just went out to them. And I thought, we got to do something bigger and more permanent. And so my nonprofit has started to work with people. We want to do an international war animals museum.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be a place where people can come and learn about how animals have served in wartime and peacetime from the beginning of time. You know, you had the elephants with Hannibal, you had camels that have served, you've had dolphins that were working with the Navy at times. There's so many animals in so many different ways that you just don't realize their role in war and also in peacetime. So I'm very, very excited about this museum. I'm hoping to place it here in Washington. Mm-hmm. And then we'll also be doing, probably to launch it, some temporary exhibits at other museums around the country or here in town. Wherever I can find a place that will house this, you know, beautiful tribute to these animals to show really how people really want to learn about this. And it's a wonderful way to learn about history, especially for kids. You know, through the eyes of the animals, you learn about important moments. In my book, there's three birds that, you know, were on D-Day. There was a dog that made the D-Day landings, you know, and what he did. And it's just amazing that you just don't realize all of that. So in November, we are doing a Medal of Bravery, an Animals in War and Peace Medal of Bravery.
Fantastic.
I'm hoping it'll become equivalent to the Dickin Medal, the PDSA Dickin Medal, but an American version of that.
Okay.
And we'll honor six posthumous animals, including G.I. Joe and Cherimee. Chips will also be one of our first recipients, as will Reckless. Now, Reckless, of course, will be number one with the medal. Even though she's the third war, mm-hmm. she's going to be number one just because. And then we'll have a war dog from Vietnam, and we'll have one from Afghanistan and Iraq. And then we'll have 3 to 5 current working dogs.
And all these animals will be recognized in the ceremony coming up
Absolutely.
In November, right?
Absolutely. November 14th is going to be up on Capitol Hill, and we're looking to maybe it becoming a congressional medal.
That's great. Well, so, I definitely wish you luck with that project.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. You'll have to come. It'll be a lot of fun.
That sounds wonderful. I'd like to check it out. And our listeners can find out more information at waranimals.com. Mm-hmm. And the book War Animals is available now. So again, Robin, thank you so much for being our guest today on Army Matters.
Thank you, Joe. It was a pleasure and honor to be here.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Keep it locked right here for all Army Matters and for next week's special edition episode. This episode will feature a discussion on post-traumatic stress disorder education with U.S. Army Surgeon General Lieutenant General Nadia West and subject matter experts from her team. Have a great Army Day. AUSA is the U.S. Army's professional association, a voice for the Army and support for the soldiers. For more information about AUSA or to become a member, visit AUSA.org.